I'm Stacey Lindis from Podcast PD, a part of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to now. Shows on the network are individually owned and opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find other interesting education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.
You're listening to the Instant Relevance Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Sheeran, math educator, speaker, and author of the book, Instant Relevance, Using Today's Experiences to Teach Tomorrow's Lessons. Connect with me on Twitter at MathDennisNJ or visit my website, DennisSheeran.com, for great resources and more information on how to bring me to your district. Now, let's get ready to learn together. Welcome to this episode of the Instant Relevance Podcast. I am so excited today to be talking with Brian Tobel. And our paths have crossed a little bit on social media and in the world around us, especially since the onset of the pandemic. And Brian is a former teacher who's turned ed technologist, who is obsessed with ensuring quality and improving learning outcomes for students. And if there's one thing we've learned from this process, it is how do we focus best on students, one by one, 5 by 5, 50 by 50. And he started his career as a science and technology teacher at the Harlem Children's Zone and then worked as an educational researcher and has spent the last 10 years building different learning apps and over 50 different educational programs for schools and universities. So Brian, again, thank you for giving me your time and being a part of the Instant Relevance Podcast. And let me pass this off to you, this question that I like to ask all of my guests, because we all come from different places and we all have different experiences. So what is it now that is driving your passion for education or really gets you up in the morning excited to be part of the education world?
Well, first, it's a pleasure to be here and thanks for having me. I'm really excited. I mean, my passion comes from, I grew up loving learning. So I was like an avid reader as a kid, and I didn't fit into the school itself. I grew up in a very small town in rural Pennsylvania, and the schools were good, but not great. I mostly educated myself through books and learning, and that sort of continued on into college, where I kept trying to find the ideal I had in my head of what education should look like, and eventually just started moving and said, you know what, let's try to create it yourself. And that's sort of how I got into the ed tech field. So what excites me right now is the energy and the attention that is coming into the space that I think is long overdue. A lot of people were outsourcing their education to institutions, to other people. And I think the exciting thing about right now is that parents have seen firsthand how well their child was actually performing in school, where they're at. And they've started to take agency and they realize that they can be successful taking that agency. So that's the exciting thing, is that there's interest from investors, there's interest from parents, students are trying new things. There's a whole world of different educational options that is opening up. And I think that's one of the best things that can happen for the space. You know, my core philosophy, and I think it sort of pours into the core philosophy of Schoolhouse, is that methodologies are helpful. They're good guide rails. There's great curriculums out there for different things. But one of the things that we say to the teachers is, what does the student in front of you need? Give them that, right? Let's not prescribe what we think is best for a student without actually really knowing them. And so what this proliferation will allow us to do is find a bunch of niche ways to reach learners that we previously couldn't before. And that's really where my passion comes from, is, you know, when I was a teacher, there were some students I just couldn't reach. And part of that was because I was a young new teacher, right? First, second year out. Mm-hmm. I didn't have the tools. But a bigger part of that, and the thing that I've sort of been, you know, working against for a while, is the size of the classroom doesn't allow you, the size of the average classroom these days doesn't allow you to attend to the needs of the students in front of you, right? Like, as a teacher, you know who your top five students are, the five who are struggling the most are, and everybody in the middle is sort of this morass, and you have to choose which of those groups you give your time to every day. And that to me was a travesty. That's essentially where the philosophy of Schoolhouse is, that if you reduce the class sizes and you make things really small, you can address the needs of the student in front of you.
So that's, It's been a big question of mine for a long time is how do I meet each student where they are and take them farther along in their learning journey? As a math teacher, I was a high school math teacher for 13 years before spending time as an administrator and now coaching teachers. And it was, how do I meet somebody again, where they are, take them forward one at a time, two at a time, however, when I know I've got a large group of kids in front of me, I've got expectations on the part of the school and the parents as to what we need to do and complete. And there are a lot of these factors and variables cycling around in the head of every teacher. And then boom, a pandemic comes in and they're like, wait, now throw a bunch of technologies that you didn't train me to use and help and still try to evaluate me as an effective teacher. So there's
right.
So the philosophy behind Schoolhouse, which I'd love you to tell me a little bit more about in just a minute, is interesting because the idea of, you know, bringing back, let's call it the one room schoolhouse, the for smaller grades, keeping class sizes down, increasing, you know, the availability to time and resources for kids has always been there. And it's been cultivated a lot in homeschool communities across the country. And so how is what you're doing with Schoolhouse and the philosophy behind Schoolhouse different? And how is it the same as some of those experiences that we might all have a general idea about when it comes to, let's call it, you know, a learning at home pod style classroom?
Right. I mean, the core philosophy is that the teacher is responsible for the majority of the learning outcomes that happen in the classroom and for sort of the satisfaction of the students and the parents. So that came from a prior company that I worked at where, you know, we were building a learning management system that would predict when you were likely to forget what you've learned and would bring that information back to you. And what we were able to see in the data was that we had some, it was for, you know, managers in customer service teams. We saw that some managers were outperforming other managers, that the people that reported to them were. And then when I worked at WeWork, I saw the same thing again, that some teachers were just vastly outperforming other teachers. We could change, like we could use the same curriculum for the same types of students that were coming in and change the teacher and the class might fail. And so I really, about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, started saying, okay, the teacher is really important. The teacher is responsible for the learning outcomes. Like it's emanating from them. What is it? What is it about the teacher that's important? And furthermore, how do I make them the centerpiece? Right? How do we make them, like if they're the thing that matters, how do we push them forward? And so the philosophy, and what that actually boiled down to is the teacher's attention is the most valuable resource that a student can get. It's not the curriculum, it's not the pace, it's not the prestige of the school, it's how much direct teacher attention can each student receive. And so if that is true, then you have to reduce the class size, right? You have to go, like in an average class right now, a student might receive 10, 15 minutes a day if you distribute it equally, which tends not to happen for each student, right? In a schoolhouse classroom, it's about an hour and a half. What that allows the teacher to do is recognize who the student is. They can see their gaps, right? Do the student have a knowledge gap? Do they have a motivation gap? Do they approach problems in a specific way that causes them to, you know, run into the same errors over and over again? And then address those gaps as they need, right? We're not saying to them, you have to keep pace to this schedule. We're not saying to them like, this is the methodology, you have to follow it. You have to deliver this group of students to this location on this date. We do want to see their unit plans. We want to see what their schedule is, but we give them a lot of freedom to deviate and to address the needs of the student in front of them. And what we found is that almost all of our micro schools are moving twice as fast. All of our students are on grade level and the majority of them are ahead. And so it's really about the teacher being able to pay attention to the student, recognize the gap or the need, the interest, and adjust based on that. And I can tell you a couple of stories that are just fascinating.
I'm absolutely sure you can, as you see the individual differences when you do get the attention from the teacher. And I think that one of the things that you just said, that quote, honestly, of how attention is the most valuable resource that our teachers have and can give. It's true. It's been true to leadership as well in you know, the
yep,
the ever regular hype of, you know, the a leader's greatest ability is availability, you know. So how is my time being made available to you? And I spend a lot of time with teachers figuring out the best way to organize the 60 minutes that they have with the 27 kids that they have in order to make sure that they get to spend valuable time to give feedback with each one of those kids every single day. And, you know, the management cycle of that is fantastic, because then all of a sudden you have a fire drill or sit down and take a deep breath and spill your cup of coffee and you lost 7 minutes and three kids got missed. So the availability to spend your time as an individual with kids, you can't, like, it does have that immediate effect of accelerating learning and accelerating understanding, as well as accelerating the relationships and the deep relationship understanding that the teacher has about the student to actually know where they are and what they need next, whether that be a mathematics conceptual pathway or a reader's writer's workshop moment or something along the way to be able to listen to and guide those kids. So that, well, go ahead.
Well, but even beyond, like, what you just referenced would be knowledge gaps. Even beyond that, like, we have a seventh grade micro school, and the teacher, Mr. Rivera, recognized that his seventh grade boys weren't very motivated. And so he built an exercise where they randomly pulled jobs out of a hat with a salary, and then he had them go out and pick all the things that they wanted to buy. They wanted to live in an apartment in New York, and they wanted Tesla and all these things. And each and every single one of them was like $50,000 in debt by the end of the year. And then he showed them the jobs that they would need and the work that they would need to do to get to these jobs. And every single one of them had like a massive motivational shift. The parents mm-hmm. reached out to us and said, like, this is night and day. Like, one of the parents said, my kid's nickname was Good Enough because all he ever did what was good enough. And now he's doing mm-hmm. all the extra credit. And he thanked the teacher at his bar mitzvah. So there's gaps beyond just knowledge. Mm-hmm. There's things that, and the teacher and the relationship with the teacher is really the first step in addressing them. And I think that's the big, that was the big eye-opening thing for me. Like, I wasn't thinking about that prior to Schoolhouse.
That's powerful, because we always say, you know, the relationship with the teacher matters, and teachers are mentors and teachers are surrogate parents, all those moments. But in a moment where they get the opportunity to spend 10 times as many minutes with an individual, they can actually yeah. act on those parental mentorship, leadership moments and, change the course of, like you said, a student's motivation, a student's interest, or even help a student narrow a focus when they're thinking about their future and say, you know what, let's not talk about what you want to be when you grow up. Let's talk about what problem you want to solve. You know, what's wrong with the world that you, yeah. that you want to be a part of fixing, and then give the student that time to develop it. So you've shared a lot about the philosophy of Schoolhouse, but let's get into some of the practical. What is, you know, a Schoolhouse look like? What does it look like? What is the day in the life of a student or a teacher or a pod really like?
Sure. So Schoolhouse enables parents of similar interest or location or need to group together and, you know, form a micro school or a learning pod, as they're commonly known. Usually it's, you know, 6 to 10, sometimes 12 children in a home. Sometimes they're in a commercial space. And it's typical, and we usually match them with like a top teacher in the area. So, you know, that's one of the things that we focus on pretty heavily is the quality of the teacher. So they almost all have 5+ years experience in the field, advanced degrees. Most of them are either like former private schools or charter school teachers. And so these are people that really know how to teach the age ranges that they're in. That was one of the big learnings that we had, is that you actually need to make this work, to give the teacher this level of autonomy, they actually need to be really strong teachers. And that was one of the bets we made, was that if you treat the teacher like a professional, professionals will come your way. So, you know, the day-to-day life would be similar to a normal classroom, right? They come in, they have their morning meeting where they discuss like what happened yesterday. They talk about what they're going to do today. And then they go through the normal subjects that you might expect with some variations. So one micro school could say that we want to be a Montessori micro school. Great. We will find you a Montessori teacher. We'll set up the Montessori curriculum. We'll set up the Montessori space. That's sort of what we handle. And another one might want to do Waldorf. Another one might want to do whatever the teacher has thought of. Right, the teacher might have their own methodology of teaching science, of teaching this grade level, that the parents really like. And that's happened a lot, where we had a teacher that was just really known in the area, was really great. And she's like, I want to start my own thing. I want my own school. Okay, well, we're going to set that up for you. So now it's this teacher's thing. It's a new Montessori, right? She gets to propagate it. The additions that have happened have been fascinating. So certain things have sort of sprung out of these micro schools, right? Like we purposefully didn't come in and say, this is what you should do, right? Our methodology here was no methodology. We wanted to see what would grow out of them, because, you know, we've got close to 300 families and more than 50 schools right now. It was a great test to see. So some of the things that were interesting are social skills. Every teacher almost independently started doing social skills lessons with their students. As I walked in to see the micro schools over the last year, they all had social skills curriculums. They all had things on their walls about, when you do this, I feel this, and I would prefer if you did this instead, right? Learning to teach them how to interact with each other. Because they're such small groups, that became really important. And then they've all taken on names. So we have I think one of them is called the Diamond Dolphin Pod. There's the Rainbow, there's the Care Bear, and that was an independent thing that grew out of that. The groups wanted to name themselves. They have values that they aspire to. So, you know, they will sit down together and say, these are the values of our school. Some teachers have set up reward systems when they display those values. So, you know, we hear stories from parents that, you know, one of the kid's brothers was teasing him and he didn't respond. And he said, Mom, look, I'm showing fortitude. right. So there are these interesting things that have come out of them. And I think the most interesting thing to me to watch is how they've all sort of adjusted to the interest and in a lot of cases, needs of the students. So a couple of the pods have gone to half day in a foreign language. We'll have like a foreign language teacher zoom in, or if the teacher themselves knows that, they will do it because the students are interested. So, you know, I saw a half day Spanish pod a couple weeks ago that was just fascinating. Some of them have started programming. Multiple have started their own business. And I think, you know, what has happened is because they're moving through the curriculum so much faster, the teachers have extra time in the day. And so they're filling that with what interests the students. And also in, you know, limited cases because of COVID, the outside world. So one pod started a art gallery in a local coffee shop. Right. And the teacher was focusing on communicating with adults. Right. And so that's the real interesting thing, right? The day to day from a schoolwork perspective typically ends early. It might end at 12 or 1 o'clock because you can get 8 kids through a lesson a lot faster than you can 30. And then that extra time is usually spent on interest-based things. And that's actually one of the things that we're exploring going forward, is this concept of like half day school, where, you know, we say school is going to happen from like 9 to 12 or 9 to 1, and then from like 1 to 3 or 1 to 4, whatever the day looks like, the students are going to be doing interest-based electives and activities. So that would be the differences. But for the most part, it's the normal education plus all of these extras that come out of the format. It's fascinating. Mm.
And it's interesting because you mentioned the foreign language teacher zooming in if they needed it. And my wife is a music teacher. My brother-in-law is a music teacher. My family is full of music education in our background. And I was curious about how you addressed some of the things like those special areas with art, the art gallery, and then having the side objective of being able to communicate with adults and the outside world. But do you do other things like music courses outside of a driven interest by the students? Are those things built into like a potential school's base curriculum if they were to say, we are following like this base curriculum or whatever, we want to make sure that art and music and phys ed are a part of it? Or is that left on the parents in the off school hours?
It's a mixed bag. And you broke up a little there, but I think I got the gist of the question. It depends on the age range and it depends on the age of the students. So for the younger age ranges, you know, a kindergarten, first grade, second grade, third grade micro school, the teachers are able to typically give a pretty broad range of experiences. And then if the group shows a special interest, then we will double down on that interest, right? So if they come in and they start being interested in programming or starting a business, we will, you know, find them somebody to create the website. We will find them, you know, a teacher to Zoom in and teach specific lessons on those things. And in a lot of cases, though, the parents have taken it on themselves to say, you know, get a soccer coach to come by. We've helped them find them. So it's mixed based on the teacher in the school itself, the students in the school itself. Again, we try to move away from prescriptive, right? We wouldn't take the philosophy that every student needs music at this age. If the group shows interest in music, we will support it. If the group shows interest in starting a company, we will support it. But we're not going to prescribe to them, hey, you should be doing entrepreneurship education here. You should be doing music education. Now, in a lot of cases, they are interested in art. They are interested in music. So they do get set up. But we move away from the prescriptive in those cases.
And I agree with that. I can see how there's an opportunity for kids to express themselves. And sometimes, you know, in K1 and 2, let's be honest, those teachers are probably singing a lot and tapping a lot and playing a lot of music or something like that, where the kids are like, wait, I like music. And then because they were introduced to something, there becomes a stated interest in following up with it more. And that's part of that experience that I'm sure they have in the classroom, is a teacher can bring up an idea or a process, or even just, you know, an example of something going on around them, and it changes the nature of their interest into something that becomes more curricular than it had planned to be. So I appreciate that, and I like that idea that there's a chance for them to follow down their interest-based pathways as deeply as those paths go.
Well, I think it's a question of, and everybody talks about it, but there's not, that I've seen, a great process for it of how do you foster a love of learning? Well, I think it especially at these ages, it probably starts by learning things that you're interested in.
It starts by saying, yeah, and it starts by not saying no to a question that got asked, or not, you know, or by allowing a question to flow into an answer. If a kid's interested or says, hey, I wonder why that works, you foster a love of learning by pointing in that direction, rather than saying, well, we don't have time for that right now. We'll figure it out some other time.
Yeah. And I mean, the other piece of that too is, you know, all the subjects are connected. So, you know, my background is not in data and data science, but my interests led me to it, right? Where I was interested in curriculum design. And then I was interested in, like, well, how do I know if this curriculum is actually good? And so I started looking into different assessment structures, started applying them, and then data came off of that. And said, well, how do I understand this data? And that interest led me into getting very deep into mathematics and data science at a later age than I, you know, but if somebody would have forced that upon me in high school or college, I know myself, I would have rebelled and resisted heavily. And I think that, like, you know, that kind of philosophy is at play here. I mean, and there is some work that the teachers do, right? When they know that something's important, right? Like fractions, mathematics, reading, writing. There is this prescription there, right? There is curriculums that they're following. Like we've seemed to have become very big fans across multiple schools of the Orton Gillingham reading curriculum, for instance. And we're seeing that, you know, when we use that, students are jumping grade levels in reading very quickly. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when something works, it spreads very rapidly, right? There's a whole community aspect with the teachers. One teacher will say, like, hey, I use this today, and the students loved it, and they did this, and then multiple do it. And then next thing you know, like, everybody's following that. So it's not this free for all, but there is space for the interest-driven learning. And I think that's the important part.
So you pointed to something a little bit earlier and have cycled back around to it as well, that aside from just the interest-based learning, Schoolhouse is intended to create a place for kids who might not have felt either comfortable or even a belonging in a traditional school. It might have been because of their own personal interests. It might have been beyond that, from just a learning situation, a family situation, a any one of a number of things that might have made them feel uncomfortable in a regular school. So how is it that you're seeing, or what is it that you're seeing within your schoolhouses that is giving those students more of an identity there and more of an experience that they are learning and appreciating there?
Yeah, let me just take a couple notes here. So this kind of ties into my opinions of the public school system has shifted in the last year, specifically after running 50 small schools, much more of an appreciation for what they do. I think by and large, for a large portion of the American population who have neurotypical kids, and the public school system works very well for them, right? I think that the school system catches a lot of flack because they're an easy target. But by and large, a lot of families, maybe 60% of the American population, is happy with their local school. Thank you very much. The problem is that the other 30 to 40%, they don't fit. And it's a very deep pain. It's a deep pain for the child. Maybe they go in and they're bullied. Maybe they are non-binary, they're trans, they're different. They might even just be smarter than the class, and they're bored. They're underachieving because, the school isn't able to teach them in the way that they need to learn. For those students, it's painful to go to school. For the parents involved, it's painful. And for a lot of people, they're locked into the school based on the zip code that they're in. So unless you have the means to pay for a private school in your area, you're sort of locked into this painful cycle. And so what we've realized is that we can deliver a better quality of education in a smaller group just about anywhere. So, whether you're a family that has some sort of mismatch with the current education system, or you're just in a school desert, which is quite common, where, there might be, one small school in your area that's, doesn't meet your needs, or and what we're seeing a lot is they build 30,000 new homes and no new schools. Or you just have a child that's different, that these small classes are really an amazing space for the child. One part of it is that there's a lot, it's impossible to have a bully in a 10 kid classroom. Right. Especially if you have a great teacher overlooking it, it just doesn't happen. It's not that schoolhouse has an anti-bullying policy. I wasn't even thinking about that problem before we started. But what we found is that and we've heard in multiple places that there was a kid who was a bully in the normal school, and now in this pod is getting along well with everybody. And it's because, one, these are the friends that they have during the day. They almost have to get along. You can't really faction off into groups like you normally do. And the other thing is that the small class sizes, and this is something that one of the teachers told me the other day, and I thought it was quite fascinating. It allows the child to adopt and try on different roles and identity. So in a large group, a student can get pigeonholed as a certain type of student for a long period of time. You can be the nose picker from third grade to 12th grade.
Right.
You can be the kid who's bad at math forever. In these smaller sizes, you can shift roles, you can shift dynamics, and the teachers are actually pushing that. So they'll develop exercises where now this child is the leader. They get to try on that role. This one's the follower. This one's the boss. This one's the employee. And they don't have to stay, because next year you could have a different group, or you could have the same group with the same teacher, but they don't have to stay in the role and in the identity that they had. They can try on new ones. And that's what we're seeing a lot of the teachers are exploring now, right? They're going beyond the education and they're saying, well, how do I actually allow this child to see what it's like to be, the owner or the boss? And so, the other piece of this too is if you have a unique need, a small school can address and adapt to that need, right? And that goes back to the thing that I said at the beginning is, what does the student in front of you need? Give them that.
Right. A small school has the ability to
adapt.
Yeah. Sorry. Just adapt more quickly. And more effectively and maintain that adaptation because there's less operational change necessary on the grand scale to adapt to individuals when the grand scale is six individuals.
And you have the teacher attention to make it work.
Right. So you mentioned that when families feel that there might be a mismatch or just that, like I said, that desert where you look around and you know there's just no resource and no way out in all directions. So what are the first steps that a family can take in order to connect with Schoolhouse and maybe start to take steps toward making this happen or a reality for them?
Yeah, so you could just come to getschoolhouse.com, G-E-T, schoolandhouse.com, and sign up there. You'll be asked to put in some just basic information about you, location, age of the child, some of their interests and things like that. And from there, you'll either be matched with other families in the area who are also looking for the same things. Sometimes families have a group already, and that's great. It tends to move a lot faster when you have other people in your area that are also interested. And then what we'll do is try to understand, like, what are the needs of the group and the students? You know, there's the students' interests and needs. There's the values of the family. And then there's how is that embedded in the local community? And so what we'll try to do is find a teacher that matches that. But we'll try to match the teacher to the needs of the group and to the community that they're in. And so that would be like the second step. So the first step is come on in, talk to us, tell us what you're interested in, tell us the age. We're going to introduce you to other families. If you have other families, that's great. Then we're going to match the teacher to your needs, to your community, to the values of the people that are involved. And then from there, we would then figure out what the space is. Do you want to host it in your home? Do you want a commercial space? Where will this take place? Great. We'll lock that down. We'll send all the supplies. We'll send somebody out to help build the space. And then the teacher gets all of their equipment. Curriculums are agreed upon. And then it just starts. And this has happened in as fast as 3 days.
Wow.
So that's the fascinating thing about this, is that we can set up a new school anywhere in the country in about 3 days. So if we really want to address inequalities, access, availability, we can do it very quickly. The issue on that is financing.
Sure. So you did mention that a lot of families feel stuck in an area when their only idea to get out or their only way to change their mismatch is a private school nearby. And I know Schoolhouse comes with a price as well. So in order to increase, like you said, the equity and the availability of some of these programs, is there anything that you do for parents who might not be able to afford the program in order to become a part of the program in the long term because of their value and their mindset toward it?
Yeah, so there are financial aids of financial aid options available. You know, the steps that we were taking is first to validate that we can actually create great schools. And we feel very confident in that. The second is making it available anywhere. So how do we actually, you know, set up a school in a location that isn't, you know, where we're at now? Like, how do we spread to a new state? How do we spread to a new town? How does this work in a city? And then the third phase would be increasing access. So one part of that is we're just constantly trying to drive down price. How do we find ways of, you know, saving money on the overall cost so that we can pass that on to the parents? One of the things we've done, obviously, is we've removed the building and the administration. You know, we've subsumed the administrative aspects. And so that cut the price by about, you know, like 30-35%. And that gets passed on to the families and to the teacher. The majority of the money is going towards the teacher's salary. The good news is that based on a lot of the prices that we have now, we have some room in order to allow like one of the students to go for free or a couple of them to go for reduced tuition. Part of the other thing that we're working on now is when we sell a certain number of schools, it looks like it's going to be like 4 to 5 that we'll be able to sponsor another one in an area completely for free. So, you know, that's the direction we're pushing in, right? Like we have to, and in the end of the day, like we have to pay the teacher. So how does that happen? And good news is that a lot of states seem to be moving their regulations in our directions with education savings accounts and things like that. So our goal is to make it so that everybody, no matter where they are, has access to a great education that they can afford. We have to work towards that goal. We're not there yet, but that's what we're pushing towards. And the good news is that, you know, based on our model, to address the needs of every student in the country, we only need around 750,000 teachers, and there's 4 million in the country. So if we can get 750,000 of them set up as micro schools, we can achieve that goal. So this is actually, I think, a very reasonable thing to do.
Well, Brian, you bring up an interesting point, which is kind of the next question, is the idea of learning pods and this smaller group of like families with one teacher has always been simmering, but it came to a pretty decent boil last March when everybody was looking for something different than the instant online schools that their public schools have provided. And so a lot of teachers as well recognized the possibility for being paid more for their time with a smaller group of students, because they could charge a family a certain amount of money and have five kids in the same room, and boom, all of a sudden they were making their salary or better. And I did notice as I was going over your information, that there's one difference between Schoolhouse and a lot of those situations, which is you also provide benefits for your faculty. Yep. So how would a teacher, who are the primary listeners of this podcast, who values your model, the philosophy behind teaching a small group of students, how would they get connected with you in order to potentially see if this could be a direction they wanted to move in?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big boon for the teachers here, I mean, obviously the increase in pay is long overdue, smaller class sizes that allow them to actually be a teacher. The autonomy is the thing that we are hearing over and over again. And it is like, you know, almost all the teachers want to stick with us, and it's the autonomy. It's the ability that you to be treated as a professional and to be viewed as a professional that can make the decisions for their own classroom. You know, the teachers, I've heard from more than one teacher that their worst of worst days was never about the students, it was the administration, which is kind of fascinating and sad. To get in touch with us, it's the same process. I think you just go to getschoolhouse.com, and at the top it says, like, I'm a teacher, and there's a sign up process. So if you're a teacher and you want to start your own micro school, whether that's in someone's home or it's a storefront, you have an idea for, you know, a full-time educational experience is what we're focusing on right now, then we're a great option for you, right? We can, you know, we're sort of like a Shopify or an Airbnb for teachers in that way. So, you know, we will help take out a lot of the risk. So, you know, we handle the insurance of the actual school, the legal and regulatory, help with admissions, health insurance for the teacher themselves, payment processing, finding the curriculum, setting up the space. Teachers get a monthly stipend on top of that to just buy supplies, which I think is far more than most of the teachers in other places do. Mm-hmm. You know, they need to adapt to the students. They need money to adapt. So if you're a teacher and you're interested in this, like, I would love to talk to you.
Well, Brian, I appreciate you sharing the philosophy and the practicality of the program. And I also appreciate that there is a focus within Schoolhouse on equity and access, and that you've set goals for these things with the realization that goals aren't intended to be met instantly. That's why they're goals, not achievements. Yes. So I applaud the thought process, and I hope that as you continue to reflect and evolve on the needs of students and teachers, that it's a successful opportunity for students to grow and learn and take advantage of the world around them and the information that it provides, and the time that they can then have with individuals who care about them and care about their learning. So thank you for being with me today. And if you're listening and you wanted to reach out, Brian can be reached to getschoolhouse.com and learn more about the program. There's a lot of information there about how it works, how to get connected, some examples of some schools, and things that, you know, you may know someone who you'd like to share this with. You may be someone who you're glad this was shared with. So Brian, again, thank you for giving me your time and your philosophy, and I hope we stay connected in the future and can maybe redesign what school is supposed to look like, because I think the way it currently is needs another look.
I really appreciate the time, and it was a pleasure to be here. And you know, at the end of the day, it's about how do we create great educational outcomes for everyone. That's what we're working towards. And I think that's what everybody's trying to work towards here is listening. So thanks for having me. And thanks for helping me get the word out.
No problem. And that's it. At the end of the day, it's about great educational outcomes for everyone. So take care and best of luck as you continue to grow.